I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler specials. This one is dedicated to the, hang on, I just can't my fingers, sixth movie in the Transformers franchise, but the first spin-off and the first prequel. It is, of course, Travis Knight's Bumblebee, in which we get to explore the origin of everyone's favourite lovable VW Beetle slash Camaro slash whatever it is that they turn into in future installments. Joining me over the next 40 minutes or so to talk about this film in detail are two of my favourite podcasters in disguise. First of all, we have... That was my little Transformers noise. Do you like it?
Amazing.
Our geek queen, Helen O'Hara, how are you?
I am well, thank you. I am all the better, of course, for having seen Bumblebee twice.
Twice. Good stuff. Next up, it is our Transformers expert, a man who's played with more Transformers toys than he cares to admit. Hello, James Dyer.
Hello. I'm abandoning my usual position as Negatron in favour of an all-new incarnation as Optimus Prime for this film.
Wow.
So, yeah, I loved it. Loved
what
a bit
happened?
Of Bumblebee.
What happened?
It's very hard to say. I've been a long-time critic of Michael Bay's Transformers film. Like, I quite enjoyed the first one up to a point, and then I have hated the others with the fire of a thousand suns because they're terrible movies that are incredibly badly made, and it baffles me that so many people seem to enjoy them. However, and I went with that particular baggage.
At what point is Negatron becoming Optimus Prime?
No, I went with that baggage into Bumblebee, and yet all of it was sort of shed within about 5 minutes because it's a delightful, lovable little feast of a film and the best Transformers movie by far. So there you go.
Wow. Mm. Okay. Wow.
I'd put it up there with the first one, but then I really liked the first one. I think the first one was, just solid storytelling. I really enjoyed it.
It has personality. Mm.
Yeah, it does. And like this, it's a story about a teenager in a car, and it kind of worked on that level.
This is essentially the same movie.
Yeah, in some ways, yeah, it is. But obviously, you know, set a little bit further back in the past, which gives it that lovely 80s sheen, which is great. But it's definitely a welcome break from the Transformers sequels, which have been exhausting to watch.
Mayhem.
Yeah, so much so that I actually genuinely did have to kind of figure out which one this was in the series because I can't quite remember. But the last one, of course, as we all know, was Transformers The Last Knight. This movie has benefited from a knight of a different stripe. You like that?
No.
I just made that up.
Yeah.
Travis Knight, the film's director, of course, more famous for his movies for Laika.
Mm.
And Helen, you like this film a lot, which is why I chose you. Like Optimus Prime, I chose you.
Thanks.
To go and talk to Travis Knight and have a good old chat with him about this movie. Did you do it?
I did, yeah. Okay. I didn't just go to the hotel and then bugger off again once you dropped off the stuff.
No, that would have been wildly irresponsible.
A little bit.
So you spoke to him about a great many things.
I did.
Spoilerific.
Indeed.
Because this is...
the spoiler special.
Indeed. So if you haven't...
seen it.
Then...
go away.
And then...
come back.
After.
You've seen it.
And then.
Listen then.
Well done. There we go. Wow. That was so much better than it was in rehearsal. That was really, really good.
It should be perfectly obvious. There was no rehearsal.
There's never been any rehearsal in the Empire podcast. And next time we'll put that to music.
Okay.
I feel there's a musical in that. A musical number.
There's a musical in all our hearts, really, isn't there?
There really is.
Even James's.
Even.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thrash metal kind of ballad, but yeah.
You lie. You lovely Miz.
That is true. I have seen it 12 times.
I can't believe it. I still can't. When was the last time you saw Les Mis?
It's been a fair few years, actually. I've not seen it recently. Obviously, I saw the film version would be the last version I saw, but I haven't seen it in the theatre. I'm overdue, actually. I'm overdue another round.
Let's go see Les Mis.
Let's go see Les Mis.
Is it still on the West End?
Yeah, it's never left.
Really?
Yeah. Yes.
Helen, you're not around.
I'm not going to be around. No, sorry.
You had made other plans. I mean,
I'd made any other plans.
Literally any other plan. I've seen it 3 times actually. I feel like that's enough actually.
Maybe I'll go and see it on my own. See.
The day before you see it, what will you be singing?
One day more.
This has gotten a little bit off track.
It has.
Here's Helen talking to Travis Knight, the director of Bumblebee, about all sorts of stuff. And yes, it is spoilerific, so be warned. But also, enjoy.
Welcome to the Empire podcast, Travis Knight. Thanks for joining us. And tell me this, how did you get involved? I haven't actually heard this one.
So it was about 2 years ago now. I had finished my film Kubo and the Two Strings. It had gone out into the world, and I got this, what I thought at the time, a relatively random phone call from Paramount and the producers of the Transformers franchise, who said they wanted to speak to me about a new Transformers film. And I thought for sure they'd gotten the wrong number, because I don't know that anyone thought the obvious director of a Transformers film would be a guy who just did this, you know, stop motion, you know, artisanal stop motion movie. I chatted with them, and the more we got into it, the more sense it made to me, because, you know, at the time they were thinking about expanding the Transformers universe and taking it in different directions and trying to think about how, like, the different kinds of stories they could tell with these characters. And as they started talking about, you know, adding some variation to those films, the more excited I got, because that's you know, few people knew it at the time, but I was an enormous Transformers fan when I was a kid. I absolutely loved them. You know, as a child who grew up in the 80s, I remember the first time that I saw the animated miniseries back in the mid 80s. You know, I watched the cartoons, I played with the toys, I read the comic books, and it started to spark all these memories, all these feelings of nostalgia, and then thinking how we could, you know, with these films, which are often grandiose and big and filled with spectacle, the thought of changing that perspective and actually focusing in on a smaller corner of that big canvas and really telling a personal and intimate story about one of these robots, it was really exciting to me. And so I met with Paramount, I met with the producers, I talked about the kind of movie I would make if they were foolish enough to allow me to do it. And within a day or two, they called up my guys and said, yeah, we wanted to do it. And now 2 years later, here I am.
Wow. So, was it always a sort of an 80s movie, the sort of almost an Amblin-esque feel to it, I think?
Yeah. I mean, it just made complete sense. As you start to think about, okay, telling an origin story about a Transformer, it made sense to set it in the era where the Transformers originated, the era they were born, which was the mid-80s. And so, and the great thing about that is that we could evoke a lot of, the great things of that era, the music, the design, the fashion, the films. And that was the area that I grew up in. And so it was just kind of tapping into that aspect of my childhood. And for me, filmically, the biggest influence on me then and probably to this day was Steven Spielberg. And I just loved those beautiful coming of age Amblin films. And they always were filled with a sense of wonder and magic and, you know, and laughter and tears. And they really, you know, got you where it hurt. I mean, I remember the first movie that moved me to tears was E.T. I saw it in the theater with my mom, and it really resonated with me. It stuck with my ribs. And so the idea of telling a story like that, that had those, that spirit that painted in those same colors, with this big expansive franchise was really exciting.
I mean, I felt like I felt E.T.'s influence in the house wrecking scene. Mm-hmm. I feel like in a lot of those, you know, Alien Comes Home With You movies,
right,
there is a house wrecking scene. Right. Something gets broken really, really badly. Was that conscious, or is that just, that kind of flows from the character?
Maybe? It's on some level, you know, a scene like that sort of flows naturally from, you know, the idea of what happens when something that has no familiarity with our world tries to learn the rules of the world and does it poorly. You know, we see that with when Charlie takes Bumblebee out to TP and Egg, this, you know, the high school villainess and her house. We see, you know, these, I started to ask myself, what are these kind of rites of passage for teen kids? You know, and part of that, I don't know how it is over in the UK, but in America, you know, TPing a house, egging a house, that's something that, you know, little mischievous teens do kind of on the regular, and certainly in the 80s. And so it was fun to think about it through that prism. But then how does your life get complicated when you have an enormous, you know, 13-foot robot? And what happens when you try to bring one of those things on one of these typical high school mischief
nights? I've often wondered it.
Many people wonder it. And so that scene there, you see how things can go wrong. The scene in the house, that just felt like a natural extension of this big creature that's in her life that tries to somehow fit in.
Let's talk about B himself for a moment, because the introduction to him I thought was really, really fascinating. First of all, his fight skills are incredible, and he kicks a head that he's just beheaded at someone else and knocks them out as well, which
it's a playful beheading.
I apologize.
Yes,
but also, and this may be me not being an expert in Transformers lore, but the fact that he's in car form even on Cybertron, so it's not even that they only become cars here, there's a
It's, yeah,
it's
I mean,
a similar looking car.
On some level, yes. Yeah. I mean, they, the Transformers, if you go back to the original animated series, the Transformers still had alt modes, even on Cybertron. Now, they weren't Earth vehicles, but, like, for instance, you see the Decepticons when they go on this strafing run early on Cybertron. They jump off this tower and they transform into these things that sort of look like jets or aircraft. And there are these things called Tetrajets, which was their alt mode when they were on Cybertron. They look kind of like a fighter jet, but they're a little bit alien. And so when Bumblebee, we see Bumblebee in his car, quote unquote car form on Cybertron. It's sort of like this Sid Mead futuristic car. It's not it's not an Earth car, but it's a means of conveyance that's kind of futuristic.
Yeah.
And so that's his introduction, where we kind of see that he's fun, he's a little bit cheeky, he's got a lot of energy, but he's also kind of a badass. Yeah. And that is an aspect of who he is.
Absolutely. Was it really important to have Optimus in there as well? I mean, it was as a viewer.
Super important. I mean, you see, one of the things that we try to do is showcase how Charlie and Bumblebee are essentially mirrors of each other. And so, we find Charlie later, we meet her later, we understand that she's endured a sense of loss. She has kind of no sense of home anymore because she's lost she's lost her father, this man that she loves. And we wanted to have a similar thing with Bumblebee, that he's lost his home. His planet has essentially been devastated and his family is gone. And he lost this guy who's his father figure, this kind of warm, he's an incredible military leader, Optimus. Yeah. Prime. He's the most iconic Transformer, but he's also, you can see just by gesture, the way he speaks to Bumblebee, that there's something else there, that there's a kind of a warm relationship. There's an almost father son relationship. Yeah. Between the two of them. And he loses him at the beginning of the movie, much like Charlie loses her father.
Yeah. You see that, I felt like, reflected later on when she's trying to shock Bumblebee back to life, essentially. Mm-hmm. It felt like it's what she wanted to be able to do for her dad when he had his heart attack.
That's right. It's like you can see her channeling these things, and she's even saying things in the midst of her grief that about how she, I can't lose you too. And she sees, I can fix this, I can bring you back. And it's all, she's in that moment, she's losing this thing that she loves, and it's very much meant to be related to her losing her father earlier in the film. Yeah.
Tell me about the Transformers designs in those scenes as well, because it feels like we've gone a little bit back to the old school, a little bit more streamlined maybe than the most recent films.
As an animator, one of the things that you always think about is something's silhouette, its shape, and how something moves. So when we set the beginning of the film on Cybertron, I wanted to see the robots essentially in their original form, the form that I was exposed to them, because there was something that was so beautiful in their simplicity. And because they actually had to physically transform when they made the toys, they were an engineering marvel, but they had to be relatively simple in order to change all the shapes to fit together. The side benefit is that anytime you saw the Transformers in battle, even though the camera might be moving in some crazy kinetic way and there might be flashes of robots flying all over the place, you always knew who was who based on their silhouette and their color. They were all distinctive. And so I wanted to go back to that feeling. I wanted to go back to that vibe. And so setting the opening of the movie on Cybertron, I felt like it allowed us the opportunity to really see these creatures in their initial form back in the mid 80s. And oh my God, it was so much fun bringing these characters to life, because those are the characters from my childhood, and to see them kind of spring to life on the big screen, it was a real thrill.
Yeah. And Cybertron itself looked, again, more like the cartoons.
I mean, the opening scene in the animated series, it was we see Cybertron for the first time with that weird little hollowed out yellow amber core, and you meet Wheeljack and Bumblebee in that very first scene, and that's kind of what the feeling we're trying to evoke here. And we see the fall of Cybertron. We just kind of do it on a big level.
Yeah. Let's talk about then Earth. Agent Jack Burns of Sector 7. Was it important to kind of bring Sector 7 back in, because it was a nice little sort of running thing through the
We wanted to have a foot in each world. There's the last 10 years of Transformers big screen movies, directed by Michael Bay, have a ton of mythology, And also, the original wave of Transformers had its own mythology that it sometimes are connected and sometimes they're not with the films. And so I wanted to have a foot in each world where we were paying tribute to the last 10 years of live action films, but also a foot in the origins of these things where we could pay tribute to, you know, that initial wave of comics and cartoons. And so Sector 7 was something that evolved out of Michael's films. And so there's it's essentially this secret society, this Black Ops military group that hunts Transformers. And there's a lot of little kind of subtle nods to the stuff that Michael has done that even if you've never seen a Transformers film, you could sit and watch Bumblebee and you wouldn't matter. But for those people who are fans of the live action series or for fans of, you know, the cartoons, there's a ton of layers of little Easter eggs and whatnot. And Sector 7 is one of them, including Jack Burns's Toady, who is Agent Simmons, who was essentially a young John Turturro, who becomes one of the heavies later in the series. But yeah, it's with John Cena, you know, I wanted an actor who could be, you know, physically formidable, but who could have, you know, layers of menace and aggression and also when necessary, a humor and pathos. And John was a bit of a revelation for me because, you know, I'd seen him as a comedic actor on a number of different levels, but I hadn't seen him do some of the things that we asked him to do in this movie. And I was incredibly impressed by what he was able to bring to this movie. And he was a real joy to work with.
He was really good. I wanted to ask, just while we're on him, his friend at the beginning, is he okay? Because I wasn't sure if he was literally lying there dying.
Poor Danny.
He had a date, no. I mean.
Yeah. Well, he didn't make it to the date, I'll guarantee you that. He was okay. I mean, the thing that we wanted to see was the difference between Bumblebee arriving and a Decepticon arriving. And so Bumblebee, he can be a force of destruction. And that's the way that Burns looks at him when he sees him, because he comes storming down from the heavens and he creates this chaos. And a lot of these guys, they get hurt. They get injured pretty badly, but nobody gets killed. They just get hurt. And from Burns's perspective, it looks like an act of aggression. It looks like an act of war. And so when they end up chasing this thing, this other, this strange metallic alien, it's with good reason. It's this thing, you know, hurt their guys. Then when we see a little bit later in the sequence, we see the Decepticon arrive, and you can see that the damage the Decepticon creates is completely intentional, and those guys are murdered. They're incinerated. The only person left from that whole squad is John Cena's character, Jack Burns.
That's what I thought, but I wanted to be clear. I also liked about his character that he's the first person I think I remember in any of these films to point out that they literally call themselves Decepticons, and maybe we can't believe everything
it's
they say.
It's a funny little meta nod that you have the Autobots, the Decepticons, I thought that was a very clever gag. Yes.
Yes. That was awesome. And I mean, in terms of, you know, you've talked about the Michael Bay films, were there points of kind of canon that you had to stick to? Did you feel like constricted that you had to meet certain things or not contradict certain things?
Yes. I mean, there is always concern with that. Although, you know, I think the continuity is certainly not a huge priority of Michael's. I mean, he prioritizes other things and, you know, incredible visuals and spectacle and fun. But even within the films themselves, as much as I've enjoyed them, there are inconsistencies. And so with this film, it's like if you're going to be consistent with one thing, you'd probably be inconsistent with another thing. So, but it was important that it had a degree of continuity. And so, you know, wanting to tell a self-contained story that wasn't, you know, necessarily bound by, you know, decades of mythology, it was a little bit tricky. We had to simplify it. And so I wanted to make sure that, you know, an audience can come to this film and it presupposes no knowledge of the Transformers. They could watch it from beginning to end and have a good time, get all the information, get all the emotion, get all the fun that they needed to have out of it. But at the same time, someone who was a Transformers fan could find other layers of entertainment. And so, yes, there are definitely things that you couldn't play around with, but there were some other things we did take some liberties with.
Everyone in this reality seems to really like Alf. So is that a personal favorite of yours that you snuggled in?
Yeah, that's absolutely me. Nobody else cares about Alf. That was me putting that in there. I loved Alf. Alf was amazing.
Alf was great.
And, you know, and Alf stands for alien life form. So it was a bit of a nod to it was to Bumblebee and his origins as well.
That's fair. He comes up a lot in the New York Times crossword. I've been trying to teach
Alf
myself
does?
To do it. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
That's useful. There you go. That's a clue every 6 months for
all
free.
Right.
There you go. I was also interested that the Decepticons may have invented the web.
The Decepticons, I don't care what Al Gore says, the Decepticons invented the internet. Yeah, you know, it's one of the aspects of Michael's films that I always thought was really fun, that kind of this alternate history, how the Transformers, how we think we know the story about how some piece of technology or some historical event, how it actually unfolded, that in reality it's just propaganda and the Transformers were responsible. You know, we looked at a number of different things, like what was going on in the 80s, what was happening in the mid 80s, and there were a couple of different ideas I had for, you know, what the Decepticons might have been responsible for, how they kind of brought something to our world. And the internet was a fun thing just because it was, you know, we can see how you know, we can see how they use it for the plot to find Bumblebee. They use, you know, their technology, our technology, bind it all together, and that's how they end up tracking Bumblebee down. But it was also kind of a fun thing because in Michael's film, his first film, the first Transformers live action film, the Decepticons essentially use the internet to find, you know, Sam and Bumblebee and all these guys to track down Megatron and all that stuff, so that they started the thing that they ended up using again years later to track him down. I thought that was kind of a fun nod.
That is, actually, yeah. It also explains a lot about the internet, I feel like. All the trolls
it's
and the bots.
Evil. The internet is evil. Force of a good, but it's also got its dark corners.
Yeah, that would totally make sense.
Yeah.
Tell me about Powell as well. You've got your first contact expert who does not do well out of first contact.
He does not. He does not fare well in the end. With Dr. Powell, we wanted to show kind of two philosophical things that are at odds with the, you know, with John's character Burns, the military man who kind of he's a hammer. He's, you know, he sees a nail everywhere. He thinks everything's a threat, and his job is to protect us from that threat. Makes sense. I can buy into that as a motivation. And then on the other hand, you've got this guy who's this high-minded scientist who recognizes that, you know, any contact with an advanced civilization, an alien species, could be used for mankind's benefit, which, again, that also makes sense. How can we somehow forge some kind of a diplomatic relationship with these things, learn from each other, help each other, and benefit mankind? You can see kind of the yin and the yang of that. In the end, they're both wrong. Powell gets the worst of it, but the part of that is just his naivete. But we wanted to show that kind of that duality of kind of looking at alien species both as a threat and as a benefit.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask, in terms of the Sector 7 scenes, about the kind of war room scene, because you've just the lit ceiling instantly made me think of Doctor Strange.
That's a little bit of Doctor Strange love in there, yeah. That's a little bit by design. You know, for the most part, we were evoking 80s cinema, but where we could, where it made sense, we wanted to, you know, give nods to the masters. And yeah, there's a little bit of that going on.
Fair enough. So more war games than Strange Love.
War games mostly came into play in, you know, how we designed, like, the computer technology and the kind of the big screens and the Cray supercomputers and all that kind of stuff. I thought about the Whopper from War Games, and that was more of a graphic influence that we used for the kind of the big computer scene in the midst of Sector 7.
And what about the other 80s influences, like music wise? This has all the hits, really, and not the obvious hits necessarily, but like a huge range. Were those personal favorites? Was it a sort of, you know, a committee of you getting together and pitching for your favorite songs?
It was a committee of one. It was just me. You know, it was a couple things. You know, obviously you're trying to, you know, music does so much to evoke an emotion, a feeling, a memory. Music is important in our lives. It's important for Charlie, and it's actually important for Bumblebee in the sense that it's the way Charlie kind of interprets the world and relates to the world, and it's also the way that Charlie, something that Charlie uses to metaphorically and literally give Bumblebee his voice back. And so it's, you know, it's a really powerful thing. And so, you know, because this movie was set in the 80s, and specifically I said in 87 specifically for a reason, because I wanted to use a number of songs that if I had said it before then I couldn't use. And so I felt that in 87 was one of the best years of that decade for music.
Is that for Girlfriend in a Coma? Because she mentions it to me.
I definitely wanted to use Girlfriend in a Coma. And you know, So Charlie, she introduces Bumblebee to music that she loves, and part of that being the Smiths. And, you know, he responds by, you know, ejecting the tape across the room. He is not having that. That reminds me a little bit about when I tried to introduce my friends to the Smiths and how they basically wanted to throw the tape across the room. But, you know, Charlie's musical tastes, they mirror mine exactly. Everything that she loves, you know, Elvis Costello, the Pretenders, the Smiths, T-Rex, these are all bands that I loved. And so that was, you know, Charlie, of course, is way cooler than I ever was. But that was a way of kind of fusing your own personality into your characters. And then, you know, we wanted to you know, evoke some of the you know, the popular rock songs and stuff like that. And you know, little glorious slices of 80s fromage, like, you know, Steve Winwood's Higher Love. But we used that as a way to showcase kind of and to presage the relationship that these two characters have when she meets Bumblebee in the junkyard, and he's just a VW Beetle. We do it over Higher Love, and we're meant to show kind of what this relationship is going to ultimately become.
And he is not a Rick Astley fan.
He's not a Rick Astley fan. He's still finding his musical taste. You know, he doesn't like the Smiths. He doesn't like Rick Astley, but, you know, he's learning.
Yeah. Well, he seems to be very into Take On Me. So I guess that's the start.
Yeah. He likes A-ha, but who doesn't like A-ha?
Who doesn't?
I mean, come on. The thing that binds us all together.
And The Breakfast Club as well, movie-wise. Yeah. You know, it's why that one in particular? Because there are a wealth of...
Because it's awesome.
...movies. Okay, okay.
It was one of my favorite movies from that era. And, you know, John Hughes was a huge influence on me and on this film. One of the things I loved about John Hughes's movies was that he always looked at adolescence and he treated it seriously. He looked at it with sincerity, with honesty, with authenticity, and he would capture kind of the fun and the humor, but also the pathos of, you know, that change that we go through in adolescence. And I just thought that bringing that perspective to the movie, that way of looking at adolescence, was important for this film. And it also paid tribute to one of the great filmmakers of the era. And, you know, as far as, you know, his body of work goes, you know, Breakfast Club was one of the best. I just thought it was just so beautifully written and so much fun. And it has the great benefit of having that incredible gesture that he copies. And it also has the benefit of having Judd Nelson, who voiced the lead Transformer, Hot Rod, in the original animated film.
So that works on a number.
Many, many levels.
Wow.
Many, many layers.
Wow.
We think all these things through. It's not happenstance.
Sure. I believe you. Mm-hmm. And actually, Memo seems like a very John Williams character as well.
John Hughes, you mean?
John Hughes. Sorry.
Yeah.
John Hughes.
There's some John Williams in the score,
sure.
For sure.
Yeah.
He kind of is. It's, you know, there's a little bit of me in all these characters. I mean, Memo's a big nerd. And when you look at his bedroom, it's essentially a carbon copy of my bedroom at that age. It's a wonderland of 80s teenage nerddom. But he's a lot of fun. He's a sweet, endearing character who, you know, on some level, he's a guy that's invisible to Charlie. Through circumstance, she has to see him for the first time, and she realizes what a beautiful soul he is, and that's what forges their friendship together. But again, it shows how, you know, how hiding, how seeing people in a certain way, how kind of putting your own projections on something, turning your back on something, how if we look at the world through beginner's eyes and see things as they are, as opposed to kind of how we think they should be, how it can open up, you know, worlds of possibilities for us.
You've also got a Karate Kid in there, and her little brother, I suppose.
Yes.
That again.
Yes, there's that. The dog Conan, pronounced appropriately like the awesome 80s barbarian and not the awesome talk show host from America. Conan is the name of their dog, and he has a little Karate Kid bandana around his neck.
Oh, I didn't notice that. Nice one. And the box, her stepdad stole a box of Malamars once. That seems like an awfully specific reference. Is that coming from somewhere that you know?
That comes from nowhere, but Ron himself, Stephen Schneider, who is the actor who plays Ron, that was an ad lib that he did, and he's so funny. I mean, the cutting room floor is littered with those kinds of strange references that our actors would bring, and couldn't put them all in, otherwise the movie would have been 2.5 hours long. But I really thought that one was a lot of fun.
That was awesome, especially the answer.
Yes,
we know
John's answer. Yes,
and Haley as well. Did she get to bring a lot to her character?
incredible. She's so incredible. It's, you know, I think she is absolutely one of the fine, the finest actor of her generation. I mean, she can break your heart with a glance. She can lift your spirit with a posture change. I mean, she's always got so much behind her eyes. This movie rises or falls based on her performance. And she is such an extraordinary actor. She's just absolutely fearless. There's the old saw that directing is 90% casting, and I think in this case it's right that you know, having her as my leading lady meant that okay, at least that part of the movie is going to work, and it did, because she was essentially the springboard for our animators too. When I looked at Bumblebee, and I would talk to our animators. This is you know, weeks and weeks and weeks, months even after we had finished shooting, as we were working on the post process, the animation. And talking about how these two are mirrors of each other, is like Haley has such incredible subtlety and range that Bumblebee had to evoke the same kind of feeling, the same kind of emotion. That, you know, this movie, the visual effects in this movie weren't necessarily about spectacle, they're about character. And Bumblebee had to be as real as Haley was. And so in that way, you know, the animators really had to completely become actors, and as they typically are. But it was about, you know, building a performance that could live on the same level as what Haley brought. And I think they did, but she set the bar really high for them. She's just an extraordinary actor.
She's amazing. So are you leaving the door open to, you know, a Bumblebee 2, or could this be the start of other kind of...
Oh, that's certainly not up to me. I mean, if the world demands a Bumblebee 2, I'm sure there will be a Bumblebee 2. But I never looked at this film that way. I looked at this film as a self-contained thing. That even though in my mind, I imagine the adventures that Bumblebee goes on after this film ends, that's always been the case in every movie that I've done, is that I try to tell a story that is meant to showcase the most important event in our characters' lives. And of course, there's many significant events that could happen afterwards. But, you know, I imagine what happens to him. I imagine what happens to Charlie. And, you know, I can imagine their stories together and apart. But for me, I wanted to make sure we told this story, and it was self-contained. And if the world wants more, I'm sure somebody will give them more.
And what's next for you? Do you know yet?
Well, so 15 years ago, I started this little animation boutique called Leica, and we've been making films since then, and we continue to make films. Our, you know, the next movie that coming out of our shop is called Missing Link, and it opens in the spring in the UK, distributed by Lionsgate, and it's a ton of fun. It's really unlike anything we've done before. It's just a beautiful movie. I'm really proud of it. And, you know, I'm developing more films at Leica. And, you know, my goal here is just to continue to tell interesting stories. It's one of the things that, you know, when I found filmmaking, when I found animation, when I found storytelling, it really felt like it was the thing that I was put on this earth to do. And, you know, I think part of that is, I think, you know, the best kinds of stories and films and art, for that matter, really do elicit empathy. They kind of remind us of our shared experience. They allow us to, you know, see the world through someone else's eyes, to, you know, feel another person's story as if it were ours. And I think that can't help but make us feel more connected. And I just love that aspect of what it is that we do. And so I'm going to continue to try to find stories that I can tell, that I can bring to this world, to make movies that, you know, somehow enhance people's lives in some infinitesimal way. I'm really grateful for this experience of directing Bumblebee. It really has been one of the most, creatively rewarding experiences of my whole life. And I learned a ton. I mean, having worked in animation for 20 years, there's a lot of stuff I knew and a lot of stuff I feel like I can do in my sleep. But this movie really challenged me on a lot of different levels. And as an artist, you're grateful for those experiences that you've never done before. I learned so much, and I'm excited to apply the things that I've learned in my films to, you know, to come down the road.
Awesome. Well, listen, best of luck with them. I've loved Leica's stuff so far, so I can't wait to see what's next.
I appreciate
Thanks very
that.
Much.
Cheers. Cheers.
So that was Helen talking to Travis Knight, and now it is our turn to talk about Bumblebee, which I thought was a lot of fun. I'm maybe not quite as up in it as you two, as Optimus Prime here, and... But I can see why you like this, because you, like me, are children of the 80s, and that means that you played with Transformers toys, I'm guessing, Helen?
I did. I had to go over to my friend Dario's house because I didn't have any, but he had many.
Been many, many wonderful toys.
Yes.
Speaking of 80s references.
Yes. But yeah, you played with Transformers toys, and Jimbo, I think you were a Transformers toy.
I am a Transformer.
All I can remember playing with is Mirage, the F1 car. That's the one that I think my parents got me.
Uh-huh. The one I wanted the most and never got was Jazz, the racing Porsche. And I love Jazz, and I never had that toy.
Jazz, of course, so horrendously killed in the first Transformers movie. He's ripped in two, and then Optimus Prime comes up and gives him a sort of, you know, a bit of a eulogy. He goes, "Oh, Jazz, he was a wonderful warrior." And then basically goes, "Anyway, moving on." Some of my favourite moments. It's amazing.
Could I just say, from an 80s geek point of view, the most exciting part of most exciting piece of information I think they got from Helen's interview with Travis Knight, which I haven't heard, but she told me about, was that the Transformer the Bumblebee fights at the beginning,
yes,
is Blitzwing.
Blitzwing.
And I hadn't got that. And the reason I hadn't got that, because I was like, well, he can't be Starscream, because A, that's not the right plane, but also Starscream is alive canonically later on. But Blitzwing, of course, is another triple changer. And the reason that's why I didn't flag it up, because he should have turned into a tank as well.
Well, yeah. And as he said, I think they were planning to have the triple change, and then, you know, money was a thing.
But you know who's missing, Helen?
I do, but tell everyone else.
Astro Train.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Other,
so the original triple changers were Blitzwing and Astro Train. Because Blitzwing, of course, was the jet and the tank. And Astro Train, as we know from the name, Helen, was a space shuttle and a train.
Which, I mean, naturally belong together.
Yes.
It makes total sense.
Yeah, he was purple and black, and I had that toy, and I loved him.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think what we're going to find in this podcast is my lack of Transformers knowledge. I've seen the movies.
Oh,
I did see the cartoon back in the day. Like I say, I played with some of them, but I was in no way, you know, in on the canon, so... Or any of the canons.
How are you spelling canon? Yeah.
See, you're not big on Energon cubes or, you know...
I realise that those are a thing, but mostly from the first Transformers...
Yeah.
Movie. Wait, Energon cubes?
Energon.
The old Spark.
Yeah, it was their fuel. Energon cubes were their fuel.
Yeah, I was I have to say, when I saw this the second time, I was looking at his Energon levels. They go up and down a lot through the film. So he can kind of recharge his Energon, right, as he goes.
Is this from his gloriously 80s wireframe heads-up display that he has? Which I thought was genius.
So on the sort of the right-hand side, they have the Energon levels. And it actually does go up and down quite a lot during the film. So presumably... he can kind of recharge himself, right?
Or it's just really badly edited. Yeah, one or the other.
Well, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt here. Like it's like maybe like one of those kinetic watches where every time you shake your wrist, he gets a bit more energy on.
Yeah.
Yeah?
That's what he's doing when Hayley Steinfeld comes home and finds him in the garage just pumping away. I'm just getting my energy on levels up. That's what I'm doing.
That's what he would say if he had a voice box, of course.
Yeah. Shake weight.
Jazzing everywhere.
No. That's wrong.
Jazz hands.
Bumblebee! I'm singing a Bumblebee song!
He was voiced, of course, by Dylan O'Brien, by the way, if anybody was paying attention to that.
I recognised the voice instantly. Yep, I said to myself, that voice, Chris, is Dylan O'Brien. You've interviewed him on the podcast.
It's Maze Runner Dylan
O'Brien. Maze Runner Dylan O'Brien. So he began and finished the year, you know. We, of course, I'm sure, as we all remember...
Cured death, Helen.
Yes, exactly. As we all remember... We definitely remember that a Maze Runner film came out this year.
You know I didn't see it. And I've seen the other two, but I didn't see The Death Cure.
It's fine. Anyway, but he began and ended the year, so well done to Dylan O'Brien.
He began and ended the year. That's the bar. Well done. You began and ended the year.
That came out a little meaner than I meant. But he's totally fine in this.
You've become Negatron.
I would never.
I am Optimus Prime.
So the first 5 minutes of this movie sent you into sort of paroxysms of just... joy and delight.
Oh, it really did.
It was
Gen 1 Transformers heaven. Just like, but seeing the Transformers as they were meant to be, you know, seeing them in their original incarnations was extraordinary.
With the transforming noise.
Yeah,
yeah. Because it's one of these things, you get the sense that obviously you get the sense that Michael Bay has no real love or affinity or affection for these characters, I would say...
Oh,
I don't think he was playing with Transformers.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay.
I think it was a gig. It was a very lucrative gig. And that's why he made 5 Transformers movies. And he did his best. And some of them were films. I like the first one a lot. But the second one, not so good. The third one, less said about that, the better. The fourth one, is a bit of a write-off. And the fifth one, But I don't think he has an affinity for those characters, Michael Bay. But I would say that Travis Knight probably
does. Oh, he
does.
No, you can tell. I mean, there's affection for this from the very, very beginning. That Cybertron sequence where you see all of the kind of favourites. You see Shockwave, Soundwave. There's Wheeljacks in there. You see Ravage coming in. Everyone loves Ravage, looking, you know, actually like a panther and not like whatever the hell he was in Bay's version.
Which one did he appear in Bay's version?
I mean, they all blend into one to me.
He's the isn't he?
He's the tape that turns into it, yeah. But, I mean, it makes... If you're going to be particularly pedantic, you could point out that there is really no way that Soundwave would have had a tape Ravage in him while on Cybertron, because obviously they have their Cybertron forms, and then when they come to Earth, they get
that
their
was my
human
question, because Bumblebee is in something like a car form,
yeah.
Well, even on Cybertron.
Yeah.
And Travis Knight's thing is that, well, yeah, he has that... It's actually an alien car.
Well, that is true. That is true. That's canonical. Yeah.
Okay, but they wouldn't have alien tapes?
Well, I mean, that feels a little bit like, yes, they're really retro in outer space.
Yeah, I guess.
Also, Ravage is not just a cassette tape. He's a micro cassette tape, which is even more niche.
Wow.
I think I had a Ravage, actually.
So did I. I've still got him. I've got him at home. Love him.
I think Dario had one that turned into a tape as well.
We didn't get Dario on.
That could have been Frenzy, who had a loud scream, or Rumble, who could create earthquakes.
I just like the challenge of putting them into one shape and then putting them into the other. I don't really remember who was who.
Or Laserbeak or Buzzsaw. They were both birds.
Well,
oh, God.
What have I unleashed?
Do you remember Zoids?
Yes, I do remember Zoids. Monster machines with the power to move.
You are listening to Stuart McConey's Nostalgia Hour. No, of course you're not. You're listening to the Empire Podcast. So yes, the first 5 minutes of this movie. This is interesting because we had a bit of a chat about this on the way over here. I really like this movie when it's not been a Transformers film. And the bits when it was reminding me that it was in the Transformers universe and it was Bumblebee fighting against kind of Decepticons, been there, done that, I kind of switched off a little bit. So the last 15, 20 minutes of this movie left me a bit cold. And even though I grew up with this stuff, and even though that first 5 minutes should have been manna from heaven for me, it didn't work for me.
Because the wounds, Bay's wounds run deep and you're slightly traumatised by it all.
I mean, maybe. I mean, yeah, it should have worked for you because, as you say, you know, I don't have the level of knowledge that you have. I mean, I just went, oh, it's the one that has the tape. Oh, it's the one that turns into the jet. Oh, brilliant. But I didn't know their names. But yeah, even though they looked like they did in the cartoons and in the comics, I was still a little bit like, oh, I'd rather get to what I've been told is kind of a heartwarming girl in her car
Amblin-esque
kind of story.
ET remake.
And it is very ET. I really did like the Cybertron scenes, just because they felt like the cartoons did. I did watch them sometimes. I still don't remember who was who. But
I mean, down to the dialogue, which is basically things like, destroy the evil and all that. You know.
I like the fact that the Autobots are the rebels. Mm. And there's a whole Star Wars thread running through this film. There's a whole thing about, like, we are the Empire. And they literally have the line, where is the rebel base in it? You know, and then, of course, you've got Bumblebee, who's lost his memory. He's basically R2-D2. He's had his memory erased. He doesn't know what's going on. And then, of course, he's had a hidden message, which when he injures himself, suddenly comes out. Do you know what I mean? It's basically a cross between E.T. and Star Wars, and that's the film.
And that's okay.
And that is okay.
Yeah. I think that it definitely borrows from a lot of films. Mm. And just, I don't know if you can get that 80s feeling without borrowing from those films. Because, you know, it's obviously not, E.T. is not the only... you know, visitor that ever went through a house and wrecked everything. But it's the one we think of probably, and its imitators have made it an absolutely cast iron trope. So you kind of expect Bumblebee to at some point do it here, and lo and behold, he goes through the house and wrecks everything by accident while trying to figure out why, you know, how stuff works. And it's super charming, but also mega destructive and expensive.
Yeah. You mentioned the first Transformers movie, and I think one of the problems that Transformers movies have all the way through is, I mean, it's just very Michael Bay, isn't it? The hypersexualization of those films. Mm. I mean, when we're introduced to Megan Fox in the first one, she's bending over a motorcycle. I love the fact that you don't get that at all with Hayley Steinfeld's character, and she feels like she's an actual, properly sort of rounded character with actual depth. And the relationship she has with Bumblebee, I thought, was incredibly touching.
Yeah, I thought it was really, really good. And full marks to Christina Hodson, who wrote the screenplay for that, I think, because
she's doing Batgirl, isn't she?
Yeah, which is I'm now, you know, very much feeling confident about as a result. Mm. I think she's done a really good job. She wrote the story for this and the screenplay. But I think that's absolutely right. I think she's just a fully developed character and she's not just the girl. Mm. And equally, you know, if that is her love interest in Memo, who I thought was super charming and really, really adorable, I really liked him, Jorge Lendeborg Jr., if he is a love interest, he's also not a cookie cutter, yeah, handsome boy love interest. There is a cookie cutter handsome boy, and he is basically ignored by the film pretty much after a couple of scenes.
Yeah, it's an odd. I mean, I wonder, that felt like it was there to kind of subvert tropes. Do you know what I mean?
Very
like
much so.
They have that. They have the kind of mean girl scene, and then they completely do away with them.
Yeah,
yeah. The last time we see the really mean girl, Bumblebee had just jumped onto her BMW and destroyed it. And I was waiting for that to come back in some way.
No, I'm totally fine with somebody destroying a BMW which has the license plate "You Wish." Because either of those facts alone would be enough to warrant the destruction of a car. But both of them together,
wow,
it's...
I love that sequence, by the way. I love him just taking the prank too far, not really realising, and then trying to hide. And it's just, he's so adorable. And I do think this is something that Bane never got, that his Transformers have no personality and Bumblebee has so much inner life. And I think, you know, Knight's sort of like a background really comes to the fore here, that his experience with stop motion animation means he has a real eye for bringing sort of silent personality to life.
Yeah, the little character beats are absolutely lovely. The scene on the beach with the two of them sort of trying out how to hide and so on is really...
He buries his head behind a rock.
Yeah,
it's lovely. And also the scene where he wrecks the house.
Mm.
And then she confronts him and he panics, shakes, cowers, and then turns into a car to hide.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, his intelligent level, if I'm honest, is a little... It's a little all over the place, isn't it? To make those scenes work. Like, some of them are a little too naive, a little too childish, childlike, perhaps is the right word.
I suppose it's because his lack of memory, I suppose, means he reverts to kind of an almost infant-like state.
So he becomes the great warrior again.
He becomes hardcore.
Yeah.
And gets glowing red eyes when he does it, so...
And goes on a killing spree.
Yeah.
And why not?
And why not?
That's the other thing I was thinking. I was watching it going, oh, this is a PG. Oh, that's nice. And then, I guess because it's robots, you can get away with it a little bit more. But robots are stabbing other robots with swords, slicing robots down the middle, reducing people to, like, gloop.
Yeah. Like, full on gloop.
Yeah.
I don't remember that happening in Mac and Me.
Yeah.
Maybe it did.
Mac John and Me. That film was shit.
It was terrible. But yeah, we should probably mention the bad guys are... So Shatter, I believe, is Angela Bassett. And Dropkick.
Yes.
Justin Theroux. I know stuff. I don't have IMDb.
Did you like the throwaway bit where the Decepticons created the internet?
Yes.
Like, that was genius.
That explains a lot about the internet, though, doesn't it? Like, a lot. I also thought that whole sequence was extremely War Games. And I'm always here for something
definitely.
That's extremely War Games. And I really, really love the fact that John Cena finally said, they're literally called Decepticons.
I know.
Because how has no one...
raise any red flags.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, people.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed John Cena. I know that there's been some mixed reaction to him, but I thought he played it perfectly as a really over-the-top kind of 80s antagonist. Mm. And just lines like, there's a door in my way, you know?
Yeah.
He's loads of fun. I got a lot of time for John Cena.
The
doctor of thugonomics.
Of course. I was worried of which school gives a PhD in thugonomics?
Well, Helen, I'm glad you asked.
Oh,
it is, in fact, Oxford University, where you yourself are an alma mater, and I suspect have a minor in thugonomics.
I don't admit that. Anyway.
What's thugonomics?
It's John Cena is the doctor of thugonomics. That's what he was referred to as when he was wrestling. When he does wrestle, I imagine he's still referred to that way. He is apparently a doctor of thugonomics.
And what is thugonomics?
If wrestling is anything to go by, it's generally sort of twatting people around the head.
Ah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Right.
Makes sense.
Yeah, get that.
What were we talking about?
I have no idea. John Cena. Let's talk about John Cena.
John Cena, yes. I was worried about his friend at the beginning. I thought that was a classic, my friend has died, and therefore I'm going to be set on your tail scene. And obviously Travis addressed this in the interview, but his friend is alive, it's fine. But I thought that was...
His friend's alive? I haven't heard the interview yet.
Yeah, his friend's alive. So I didn't realise that.
Did they not want to show that? Did they show
that? I guess they don't ever bother going back to him. He did miss his date, canonically. That's what Travis Knight says.
Okay.
But he is alive. And I honestly was kind of surprised by that. I thought he had died and that was why he then becomes obsessed with finding Bumblebee. Not that he doesn't have any other reasons to do so, I suppose.
His mate gets fridged at the beginning.
Yeah.
John Cena's not happy about it.
Yeah.
He wants to find the Bumblebee, who, even though he's seen Bumblebee being very nice and go, hey, look, this is a mistake, he still wants to shoot him and stuff.
I'm interested in how far Bumblebee got from the mountains down towards what is clearly Santa Cruz type area. I mean, that's quite a long drive. I've done a drive like that. It's a long way.
I mean, he's literally a car.
Well, yeah, but he's also super dead practically.
Yeah. What's the time frame of this film? Because it's obviously 1987. Bumblebee arrives on Earth, pisses off John Cena and the army, gets shot to shit, loses his memory, loses his vocal cords, careless. It's a hell of an afternoon. And then just with his kind of, just before he passes out, scans the VW Beetle, presumably becomes a VW Beetle.
Yeah.
And then next thing we see, he's in Henry Reagan's junkyard with the bloke from Blue Bloods.
Apparently.
But how?
Well, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe they found him and he got sold on eBay to the guy from Blue Bloods.
But
no eBay. 1987.
You make a very valid point. What was the 80s version of eBay? Car boot sales.
Antiques Roadshow, I think.
Yeah.
Classifieds, Auto Trader, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But there's no paperwork.
He's obviously just, gotten down there. I guess we shouldn't look too carefully at these things, I suppose.
Well, it's just because whenever Hayley Steinfeld's character, whose name is?
Charlie.
Thank you. So whenever Charlie goes to Uncle Hank's big garage place, it's clear that Bumblebee has been there for some time because she's like, I really want that Volkswagen underneath the thing. So how long has Uncle Hank had that car?
It's a good question.
Feels like a while.
I need to get Len Carreyrou, who plays Uncle Hank, a.k.a. Henry Reagan. Could be the same guy. Could be the same character.
It could be.
Hank, Henry, from Blue Bloods.
The Blue Bloods cinematic universe.
A.k.a. the worst character in the history of television. But I thought he was okay in this, so that was all right.
Did you not think, and I felt really sorry for Bumblebee because I thought he was outmatched by John Cena because obviously, because it's John Cena, Bumblebee could never see him coming because you can't see him because he's John Cena.
Is this something to do with Thuganomics?
I believe this is a signature John Cena move and a sort of in-joke in wrestling.
Yeah.
I only know that from watching an episode of Graham Norton, though. So
it is true. He waves his hand in front of his face and says, "You can't see me." That's
what
he does.
Yeah.
See, all I have to go in with John Cena is that scene in Trainwreck, in which we very much did see him coming, so. Not sure that
you
works
look
for me.
Like a dude! I love that film. Well, I don't love that film, but I love that scene in that film.
Well, we'll have to unpack that one day with a trained therapist. Yep.
Paging Dr. Freudimus Prime. Wow. Okay. Anyway, so I wasn't sure that Cena worked necessarily as an antagonist because I don't think his character was consistent, basically, from one minute to the next. What does he want to do? Does he want to find Bumblebee? Does he want to kill Bumblebee? Does he want to save Bumblebee? Mm. Make your mind up, pal.
I think he's actually, I like him, and I think he's pretty consistent because he is generally out to capture this dangerous thing for most of the running time until he realises that it's the lesser of two dangers.
Yes.
He described it, I think, himself as a sort of heel to babyface turn, which is another wrestling term that I learned mostly from Graham Norton.
I know what a heel is. What's a babyface?
Babyface is a good guy.
I thought they were just faces.
Well, I don't know. He is the term.
Oh, okay. So face and heel. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good.
So he actually kind of comes around. But I quite like that. That has happened in other things. Again, if we're using the ET analogy, he's a little bit like the character who looks like Spielberg, whose name I forget.
Peter Coyote.
Sure.
It's Keys.
Yes, Keys.
Okay. So you think it's him? Okay.
I think it's kind of like him.
All right. Interesting. But one thing I did love about this film was the relationship between Charlie and Bumblebee, which I thought was really, really lovely, really, really sweet. And can I just say that this shit ain't easy. Hayley Steinfeld deserves a lot of plaudits for her performance in this because she's acting opposite. I don't know what the hell she's acting opposite.
A ball on a stick. Yeah. A guy. Yeah. I mean, who knows?
A guy waving a flag. Three people wearing orange outfits. Who knows? Who knows what she was acting opposite? But to infest that performance with the believability and the heart and the charisma that she has and soul that, that she shows is no mean feat.
I also think this is a really, this is a film that makes a an unusually good use of the dead parent trope in a lot of kids and teen films. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's, you know, I think it's cheap and it's overused, and a lot of the time they're stripping the parents away so the kid can have an adventure. Because if your parents are there, you're going to be okay. That's kind of the feeling that you get. So in this one, it is a there is genuine upset that runs very deep in her character. It's not always addressed, you know, overtly, but stuff like the scene where she's shocking Bumblebee back to life, I thought was just a beautiful little scene of like her dad died of a heart attack. She's not just seeing Bumblebee at that point. She's seeing a chance to sort of almost change the past. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just phenomenal sort of storytelling, kind of, you know, echoing. But yeah, she gives it some real emotional heft that I think it might not have had in lesser hands, both as an actress and in terms of writing and directing as well.
Mm-hmm. Kudos as well to the writer of the film, Christina Hodson, for constructing the hoops that she has to jump through in order to get Charlie to actually dive into water as a plot point.
Yep. I mean, I'm not sure how specifically she helped once in the water.
Yeah, like exactly that. Like he was going to be fine or not, and there's, I mean, it's not like you can give him the kiss of life. He's a robot, so
she sort of inspires him, I guess.
She swam down, dove in, and gave him tacit moral support, and that brought him back from the brink.
A punch in the shoulder, a little tap. There you go. You got this, buddy.
Yeah,
that was interesting.
I did like that final fight between Shatter and Bumblebee when they have the big thing. What I really liked about that is, and I thought when that kicked off, I thought, oh, here we go. Now we're back to Bay territory. And we weren't. And I think there were two reasons for that. One, I thought the choreography was actually quite inventive. They did interesting things. Mm. They weren't just wailing on each other. And also, I liked the fact that we kept cutting back to Charlie and seeing the action to a certain extent from her point of view. Mm-hmm. So you kept that kind of human element to it, but it also grounded it and stopped you getting quite bored of the sort of metal on metal action. That was a really good decision, I thought.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And Shatter was a properly scary opponent at that point. She's a lot bigger than Bumblebee. She's a really formidable fighter. The first couple of punches she lands in that fight, or, you know, moves, whatever, they look devastating. And I think that's really important, because otherwise you'd be like, well, he's the guy above the title, so he's going to be fine.
Yes.
But you actually kind of worry for him for a second. You're like, how's he going to get out of this? Are the other, you know, is Optimus going to have to turn up and save him? Like this.
Yeah.
I genuinely was wondering at that point. So I don't see how he beats her on his own, which he didn't either, and he came up with something clever.
Well done, Bumblebee.
Good work.
Yeah, I was expecting Optimus Prime to turn up at the end and save him as well, but that would have kind of defeated the purpose, really, of the movie.
Yes.
Otherwise, we'd be watching an Optimus Prime movie.
But the lovely bit on the Golden Gate Bridge is great.
Yeah.
It is good, although how does this fit into the timeline, do you think?
Well, I mean,
not that we really care.
No, I mean, Travis slightly sidestepped it, this one, as you notice in the interview. But it basically, it's more or less the same canon, but they had a little bit of wiggle room, I think. So let's assume that they're all on Earth right now, they regroup, and then at some point in the 30 years in between, they've gone off and had some other adventures. How do they launch themselves back into space? I don't know, but I'm sure they have ways. They're Transformers. They probably just take a junkyard worth of stuff and make a spaceship out of it or something.
Yes.
I mean, we know how they land. But this is the only time we've ever seen them take off, and they had a special tower to do that. Presumably, they must have other ways of doing that, unless Shatter and Dropkick have brought one with them to the moons of Saturn. Honestly, some of you out there probably know the answer to this and are going to deluge me on Twitter with all these.
Yeah, all about the Energon cubes.
Right, but how, though? Okay, but don't tell me. Anyway, the point being, they've probably gone off to another planet and then come back to this planet.
This is like Heston Services for Transformers, isn't it? That's basically what it is.
I guess so.
It's the stopping point. You stop here for a few minutes, you refuel, you grab yourself a Kit Kat, maybe a drink, maybe visit a bog, maybe don't. It's entirely up to you. But then you don't want to be holding it for another 2-3 hours until the next service station. So I would definitely go to the toilet.
Now I really want a Kit Kat.
I really want to go to the toilet. Do you want anything, James?
I'm good.
Cornetto?
Sure.
Good.
Mint.
I want to go back to the Charlie relationship with Bumblebee as well, because you're right, this is the first movie. Am I saying that you're right to myself from 20 minutes ago? You're right, me, from 20 minutes ago. This is the first movie. But as much as I like the first film, and as much as I thought at the time the Shia LaBeouf's performance as Sam Witwicky was a breath of fresh air in terms of blockbusters, in that you had this kind of almost panicky, realistic, Woody Allen-y,
yeah,
back then, kind of, you know, protagonist dropped into the middle of this big action movie. And it was a real breath of fresh air. Now you look at it and you go, oh, I'm not so sure about that character. But Charlie is a really refreshing protagonist to hang your hero coat on. And you're right about the dead dad thing. That could have been a real sort of
cliche.
Cost to bear.
Really, I also like the other parent dynamic. I like the feeling that it had that very Spielbergian thing where you felt that the ultimate arbiter of authority wasn't the shadowy government agent. It was actually parental disapproval. Like having your mum mad at you is, in these films, the worst that life can possibly get. And there's echoes of that in this there. And I really enjoyed her mum in this.
Yeah, she was great.
It's a lovely touch. I think
the whole family dynamic, actually, is really well done.
And the fact that the stepfather was actually a really nice, if doofusy kind of guy. The moment where I saw this on Miami Vice, you know, when he does the little, the car chase, in inverted commas, which is the man, I mentioned this in the review. This is the main point of differentiation, I think, between this and the Bay films, is there's a multi-car pileup in which almost no cars sustain any damage whatsoever. It's like the most tame incident ever. Whereas you can imagine Bay would have found a way to have like a sinkhole open and the entire city fall into it. In here, you get a slightly dinged bumper.
Yeah, I have to say, I liked the lack of massive damage because the other film out in the same week as Bumblebee that we're going to be also spoiler specialing, Aquaman, has loads of insane amounts of collateral damage that is just never mentioned again.
The body count is catastrophic.
The body count is unbelievable. I mean, genuinely, it's certainly tens of millions, probably hundreds, and it's never mentioned. And yet here we have, you know, the stakes are, as you say, they're lower, and it's all the better for it because they're more human, they're more understandable.
Yeah.
We can kind of comprehend that.
The worst thing that happens in this film is that the house gets trashed and her mum is going to kill her. Like, that's as high as the stakes get.
Yeah.
I also like the fact that it wasn't just a retread of Sam's parents.
Yes.
From the first Transformers, who were really lovely at the time. And then as the sequels went on, they got more and more to do and they just got a little bit more crass and just didn't quite work. And there's a tendency with the Bay Transformers movies to give in to that sort of crass humour. So you have Transformers, you have Autobots pissing on John Turturro, you have robot balls, all sorts of stuff. This movie didn't go down that road.
No.
Great soundtrack as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
This wall-to-wall bangers.
Yep. Although I have to say, this is a film set in 1987 and there's no REM on there. The document, their album Document, came out in 1987 with It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine and The One I Love and Finest Work Song, any one of which would work gangbusters on this soundtrack. I was waiting for It's the End of the World as We Know It to kick in, but alas, no.
Maybe it's overused now.
Yeah, I think. Also, it doesn't feel 80s to me. Like, it feels more timeless, R.E.M. It doesn't feel like it's pigeonholed to the 80s.
If she's listening to the Smiths, she's listening to R.E.M.
But I love that moment, which is not a Smiths fan when he spits the tape out. That's great.
Yeah.
Also not a Rick Astley fan, though, so let's give him his due.
Also funny. I also like the John Hughes motif going through the whole Breakfast Club thing with the Simple Minds bit. And the fist pump. Love the fist pump.
Yeah, that was also, and without wishing to read too much into this, right, the Michael Bay movies, not just the Transformers series, but a lot of his movies have really glorified American militarism. And there is this tendency in the American culture, certainly these days, to not just respect the military, but really glorify the military.
Almost fetishize it.
Yeah. And I felt like, you know, John Cena salutes him and he returns with the fist pump. And that is a gesture I don't think Michael Bay would have done. Again, I think he would have saluted back. I think he would have. Yeah. And I really liked that he didn't. And that may be reading way too much into it, but it really worked for me.
Fair enough. Very quickly on a Smiths note, it's been an interesting year for the Smiths and Morrissey movies. There's a big thread about them in Ant-Man as well. Uh-huh. And now in this movie as well.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's coincided nicely with Morrissey going off the deep end politically. So that's nice.
Well, yeah.
Well done, him.
Ooh.
Well done. Best touch in the movie, best musical touch in the movie was the use of, well,
the touch.
The touch. I really liked that.
That was
good.
That was very clever. That was, of course, if I'm right, the theme song of the original Transformers, or is it just in the movie?
The movie. Yeah, absolutely. And it was recorded famously in Boogie Nights.
Yes, I remember that.
By Mark Wahlberg, who, of course, is the star of
some of the Transformers.
It's all connected.
Sequels.
It's all coming full circle. He is, of course, Digglertron. See what he transforms into?
That would be terrifying.
It's a whole different kind of film. let me tell you. Anything else to add on this movie before
not
we wrap
after
it up?
That, no.
No, that's it. I just want to read out one bit of trivia from the trivia page of Bumblebee on the IMDb. This is the first live-action Transformers that Michael Bay did not direct, but he stayed on board as producer.
Right.
On that bombshell, that is it for our Bumblebee spoiler special. It's been quite fun. It's been good. I've enjoyed this. We should do this more often.
You don't have to sound quite so surprised.
Well, I didn't think I would get quite so much enjoyment from talking about a yellow car. It's the greatest
yellow
game
car
to play. In the,
did you not find that really distracting during the film? Like in every scene, like there'd be someone on your own going, yellow car, yellow car,
yellow car. But you can't do, you can't do the same car.
That's true. You only get to yellow car once. Yeah. So once you've done Bumblebee, there's not very many other yellow cars.
Well, yeah.
There's that one
the
in Yosemite or wherever. So we should explain. This is a game that I think I introduced to the Empire crew when we went on a field trip once. And the game is this. If you see a yellow car in traffic, say yellow car and you win. That's it. Okay. It can't be parked. It can be stopped at a light, but it can't be parked. Mm-hmm. It has to be a car, not like a van or a lorry. Those don't count. And it has to be yellow, not like gold.
This is based on the principle that yellow is the least common colour of car.
Yes. And it's actually quite challenging in places with yellow taxis, which I generally disallow.
Yeah, that's so definitely a disqualification.
A New York taxi wouldn't count. But that makes it harder to then spot the yellow car that isn't a taxi. So it's a real game of skill.
Yeah. We once had a yellow car. My dad owned a Nissan Sunny.
Wow.
Datsun Sunny Estate.
My mum had a yellow Beetle. So it's entirely possible that I know Bumblebee personally.
My mum had a yellow Mini Cooper.
I mean, I still think I win.
All three of us had yellow cars, is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
That's amazing.
That is.
That's amazing. And on that bombshell, it's the end of the podcast as we know it, and I feel fine. Thank you so much for listening to this spoiler special. Our next spoiler special is going to be, I don't know. I don't know what our next spoiler special is, because then we'll be in 2019 and... Who knows what delights will be thrown at us in the course of that year. Keep your ears peeled for more spoiler specials coming your way. The regular podcast is up every single Friday. In the meantime, thank you so much to Helen O'Hara.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Well, okay then.
Thank you, of course, James Dyer.
Autobots, roll out. That's all I've got.
It's all you need.
It's all you need. Thank you, Helen.
And it's goodbye for me. I'm off to check out the frozen banana stand because you know what? There's always money in the banana stand. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time. Bye.